This is United Tribes News Radio. Insights into Native culture, people, ideas, topics to improve understanding from United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. The United Nations takes special interest in the welfare and well-being of Indigenous people. Around the globe, including in the United States, the UN focuses attention and resources on the circumstances facing First Peoples. As the UN puts it, these are people who may experience the consequences of historical colonization and invasion of their territories, and may face discrimination because of their distinct cultures, their identities, and ways of life. In other words, the international community, represented by the UN, pays special attention to the human rights of Indigenous people. And one of the methods they use is to conduct thematic studies on special topics related to protecting Indigenous people's rights. That's why a representative of the UN visited North Dakota in 2017 to focus on how energy development has affected tribes and tribal people in this region. In this program, some of the dialogue tribal people had with Ms. Victoria Towley-Corpus, the UN's special reporter on the rights of Indigenous peoples, during a listening session at United Tribes Technical College.
I like to say a prayer in my first language, which is Lakota. Sichanghu Lakota Yati. I come from the Rosebud Sioux tribe. I'd like to welcome the people that are here from long distances to come and listen. We have a lot of problems here in Indian country, and we struggle. We have these struggles, and they're very evident, and a lot of us are affected wholly by these things. And so I want to ask all of you to, as I say a prayer, you say a prayer in whatever way you pray for the same reasons, hopefully finding solutions to what we have to deal with within Indian country. Hoi tro tungashla tratia topana. Oh, Wagatakya, Wambligashkoyate, Anukhasan, Hola Hokutakya, Uchimakha Kanyukonki, Hola Tukashla, Lehianiki, Ho, Nitita Kuyaki, Renakacha, Unhina Shibna, Ho, Wuchiki, Nitarok, the Lord Tukashla, Tukashla, Uyatiki, Otechia, Le Abetuki, Wichao, the Lord Tukashla, Chaya. Etchi omniche gile und hanter gash taku hena onke abokiuki hena ucha ukayeta palot gash ikche ucha she on choki hena yuha ushika palot gash ushika palo na taku hena lechim se ichuko mata gash trokatekia makhajen hoch na hachi hibshnike hena und hanter gash iwashtok telo Kya echuxile tukashila, ikchewichasha hemacha, ikchewichasha un wuchiki gilena chichijaga belo tukashila, ea oyakyok telo tukashila, oyakyoki ho omnitiki leta taku washte hiuk telo tukashila, naha huch lila treha, ulecha hihonioki ho tukashila, hena awainchila kiki ho tanzania. Yok piha tiwahet haki ekta wichaki honiok to lot gasha. Ya hechim se hochi chapelo. Homitaki uyasi.
At this time, we would like to officially welcome our friends from the United Nations. Today, here we have Victoria Towley-Corpus, United Nations Human Rights Office of High Commissioner, United Nations Rights Office. Accompanying her, we have Heek Young Yu. And then we also have Carla Fredericks, Director of the University of Colorado Law and American Indian Law. Give them a round of applause, please, for being here with us today.
Thank you very much, Melvin, for hosting this meeting for the United Tribes College, for hosting this event, and for all of you to find the time to come here and speak with me. As you may know, this is part of the visit that I'm doing, which is called the official visit of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to the United States. And this is a visit that has happened upon the invitation of the United United States government for me to be to visit the country and to look into the situation of how the human rights of indigenous peoples in this country are being protected, respected, or violated. So I'm here to hear the stories from you in terms of how you think your rights are being respected or protected by the government or otherwise violated, because that's the main purpose of my mission, to look into this situation, to identify what are the obstacles to the protection of indigenous people's rights and what are also the good practices from the side of government as well as from the side of indigenous peoples in terms of asserting and claiming their rights. So this mission is held for 10 days. This is almost my 8th day, I think, but the mission is going to end by March 3, where I will present my end of mission report to the U.S. government in a debriefing meeting, and I will also make a press conference. But after that, I will prepare the comprehensive report of my findings and my recommendations, and this will be presented before the UN Human Rights Council in September of this year. So this opportunity is an opportunity for me to hear from you, so I'll be listening to what you would like to tell me. And the theme of this mission is really focused on energy development and how this is impacting on the rights of indigenous peoples and the efforts that indigenous peoples themselves are doing to generate or develop their own energy sustainability. So this is the focus of my report. So if you will speak, I would suggest that you focus on how these kinds of energy development projects are affecting you, and also to tell me what are your recommendations in terms of how your rights can be better respected and how your own self-determined development can be undertaken? What kinds of messages would you like me to relay to your government so that when we are meeting, we can enter into a dialogue with them as well? So this is the way that this mission is being conducted. It's usually done in 10 days, and all the key messages and the stories that I hear from the people I've talked with will also be put in the report which I will be preparing, that will be presented before the Human Rights Council. So thank you again for this opportunity, and I would I'm listening. I'm going to listen carefully to what each of you would like to say, and I know there's a list of those who registered to speak out, so we will start with that list.
Our first distinguished individual who would like to speak is the chairman from the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe, Brandon Sazu.
First of all, I thank you for this most historic opportunity. My name is Brandon Sazu Sr. I am the chairman of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. 565-294-382-342-UU-00-2254, number 137. Those three numbers I just told you is I'm recognized by the state of North Dakota by those numbers. One was my Social Security number, the other was with my tribal enrollment ID, and the other was my arrest number on October 27, 2016. And two of those numbers I'm recognized by the state of South Dakota. So on the average citizen, they're only recognized by their Social Security number, whereas we're recognized by many numbers instead of by who we are. What I have before me is the Crow Creek Wind Project, Wind Resource and Project Feasibility Report I'll be giving to you. We start with the Pick-Sloan Act. I believe it goes back to the 1940s. When our dams were created, our bottom lands were taken along the Missouri River. We were forcibly removed so they could build dams, thus creating hydropower. So since that time, up until now, we have one of the largest electricity rates, if not in the world, but in the country. Hundreds of our people are cut off electricity every month through harsh conditions, through harsh weather. We don't receive anything off our hydroelectricity. We receive nothing. Crow Creek is fortunate to have one of the biggest substations in the United States, but yet we still receive nothing and we're still poor. So we jump up to wind energy. In 2012, 2013, the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe submitted a grant to the Department of Energy of the United States, in which we received $176,000 to go towards our wind energy, in which case in December 6th of 2016, we put up our first wind energy data tower called the Met Tower. So we are looking forward to building wind energy. And the problems a majority Indian country faces: funding, transmission lines. But Crow Creek is fortunate to have our substation with our transmission lines right there. So how do we move forward with wind energy when we barely even got the grant? And now more so, our funding is being cut by the United States government, and they are all going towards fossil fuels, which is desecrating Mother Earth, is desecrating our burial grounds. There are no words I can describe to what the United States did to the indigenous peoples of the United States, the First Nations people. We've had to fight from the beginning, and we're still having to fight, building a dam, kicking us out of our homes. Here we are again with the eminent domain and the big oil companies coming through, doing it to us again, violating our rights. October 27, 2016, I was arrested in North Dakota. I was humiliated, and they're telling you to do this while you're standing there watching your people get shot just because of clean water. We move on to states passing bills to, again, humiliate the tribes. North Dakota tried to pass a bill to take over North Dakota tribes, saying we were illiterate, saying we were poor, we didn't know how to educate ourselves. But ultimately, they pulled the bill. South Dakota is getting ready for Keystone XL pipeline. They are violating their own constitution of the First Amendment, the freedom of speech, and the right to assemble. Now, the government says it's going to create thousands and thousands of jobs. That's ridiculous. It will only create enough jobs to build that pipeline, and once that pipeline's finished, there's going to be less jobs to maintain it. So the railways, truckers, they're going to be out of jobs. But it's all about big money. And I believe that's what the government is doing to us right now, especially more so people of color, the banning of Muslims, ultimately, and hopefully not taken over on tribes by letting the states do so and giving the states more power to take over on tribes. We have been fighting since the beginning. We are trying to fight. We do have wind energy going on. We do have, in South Dakota, I believe in North Dakota, wind energy, where all the tribes are on board trying to do wind energy, but the obstacles are we don't have the funding for it. We have the greatest places on earth for wind energy, but yet we do not have the funding for it. Why do we remain poor? It's because they keep us poor. We're not meant to succeed for whatever reason. But yet, as indigenous peoples of this world, we're here to fight for the world because we need to let the world know that the earth is a living being. It creates life, and it continues to create life. We cannot destroy that. We need to go green, otherwise we're putting the world at risk. I came here because my heart is broken, my people's heart is broken. We're here for all the living things on this earth to get the message out to the United States of America that you're destroying it. You're destroying its people, you're destroying other people, you're destroying families, you're destroying homes, you're going to destroy crops, you're going to destroy animals. Life is important. When do we start to fight for life rather than take it away?
Can I just ask you a question? I know that you're affected by this Keystone XL pipeline. I would just like to know, have you been consulted? Because I had meetings with the BIA, the Army Corps of Engineers, and they said that they have been undertaking consultations. So I'd like you to comment on that.
No, the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe has not been consulted. As a matter of fact, in June of 2016, the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe filed a $200 million lawsuit against the United States government for our water rights, and we've never been consulted.
And, of course, that's a violation of the treaty rights that you have with the United States government as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you very much, and we would look forward to talking with you in the future. As you may know, I will be presenting a report before the government, so we would also like you know, your presence whenever we will present this report before the Human Rights Council in Geneva.
Next on our list of testimonies, Mary Louise Wilson, Defender, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe.
I had just one copy of this little booklet called The Taken Land, and it's attached on yours. And it tells the story of three people who had to move way back in the late 50s and 1960s. Although 25% of our people on the reservation had to move from their homes, we always knew that they were never justly compensated. So in 1992, working with the three affiliated tribes, they had this thing they called JTAC, and those became law. For Standing Rock, the amount of $90 million was deposited and the interest would be available to the people. Again, these individual people who lost their trust lands waited and waited for their turn to be at the trough, but the money was used for other purpose. And we noticed that the people were dying, and so we formed our Oahe Taken Area Landowners, and we tried to get some compensation, which we did, for those who lost 40 acres or more to the Oahe Dam. And this was a drop in the bucket, and after discussion, examine, and the history of all of this, what was going on, how come they had to build dams and so forth, we found that the Western Area Power Authority, that we refer to as WAPA, was marketing the power from the dams for huge sums of money. The then chairman, Charles Murphy, wrote a letter to WAPA for us, and we had one meeting with them, but we lacked the resources to hire a good writer lawyer, travel to WAPA headquarters, and so we didn't do anything more. That letter is enclosed. Now it appears to us that the prime reason for the dams, at least this was what the people were told way back when this started in the before 1955, I was working at Standing Rock Agency as a young woman, and I'm now 86 years old and still trying to see that something good will happen to our people. But way back then, all they talked about was flood control and irrigation. And nowhere in all of these laws that were passed was that they would be generating all of this electricity and power, and that had to be looked at. But it never was. Now, way back before the JTAC started in 1986, there was this joint tribal advisory committee, the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation and Standing Rock. And then there it says, furthermore, the tribe maintains that they're entitled to receive a substantial percentage of the power revenues generated by the Oahe Dam, perhaps as much as 50%. They base this argument on the premise that they would not have given up their homelands without receiving a substantial percentage of the benefits accrued from Oahe Dam. The analogy presented in testimony was that if a Rockefeller had owned this land, he would not have given it up without bargaining for a share of the profits from the power revenues generated by the waters that flooded this land. Well, the committee does not pass judgment on these claims. The committee recognizes the tribe has preference rights to power on the same basis as local governments. Okay, that's all they did. And you know, that power is sold for millions, and I think it's sometimes $1 billion. It's hard to understand on the marketing of power, but there is all of this information there. And I don't know what we can do. We're still stuck with that, you know, not having the resources to do what we feel we need to do with that terrible loss, and why we can't actually have some benefit, because as I think Mr. Zazu mentioned, our people are very, very poor. There's very needy people on our reservation, and many of them are the people who gave up their land, who gave up their homes, so that all this could happen. And I wish there was somewhere we could go so we could proceed with what we started way back when. It's kind of us old ladies that get together and sometimes, you know, don't understand all these new modern things. And I hope that you will be able to study those documents and that you will maybe have some ideas of what we might do.
Thank you very much, Mary Louise.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for sharing with us this story. We'll definitely look into this as well with the lawyers who are with us. Thank you.
At this time, we'd like to call Rusty Gillette from Three Affiliated Tribes, MHA Nation, to give testimony.
Thank you for being here. Coming here today, I never really expected to say anything I just wanted to listen to what people had to say. And as I, you know, listen to people, I'm here today as a common man. I'm not a tribal elected official. I'm not a spiritual leader. I'm not a political strategist or anything like that. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a normal father to my children, and I care about their lives very much. So, and I feel like in your recommendations, you know, I'm asking you to define what tribal consultation means, because there's, you know, it's not the first time we've heard this, but there's been ways around it, and the government has suppressed us so much to justify everything that they've done, whether it be passing bills, passing laws, you know, to some tribal consultation might be an email asking, I'd like to visit with you on this, will this day work? No, that day won't work. Let's try this day. No, that day won't work. Let's try this. Pretty soon we have 5-10 emails traded, and pretty soon 10 emails is considered tribal consultation on the subject. So there's been a lot of things like that where we have been suppressed by these laws that have been passed and justified, whether it be dams on our reservations, whether it be pipelines coming through our reservations. How do we take a step back and gain our rights and enforce those rights as people? Because right now our problem is we can't enforce those rights. You know, when President Obama issued an environmental impact statement or survey on our lands, you know, for years we've had non-Indians come in, and we've had to plead our case to people, to non-Indians, whether and tell them why these places are sacred. Tell them what's there. Tell them why this is special to us. Only, and my question is why do we have, how do we eliminate this? How do we eliminate people telling us what's sacred to us? Why is this special to us? Why do we have we don't have a right to fight for these things? And so, you know, being in North Dakota with the pipeline, everything going on right now, we're stuck in this battle where the media takes the reaction of all this, takes the reaction to people protesting, to people getting arrested, to everything from the beginning all the way to camp cleanup has been portrayed in a negative aspect, because people don't understand what the fight is for, and that's protecting our tribal sovereignty, protecting our rights. My argument and my plea to you guys is to try to find a way to continue and gain those rights, because right now we don't have them. You can suggest tribal consultation, but how do we enforce that, and how do we find ways around it? Because honestly, the government can find ways around what we have in place now, and that's obvious. But I'm just trying to change your way of thinking and taking a step back, because they're going to find ways around your recommendation. Everything from how do we not be so dependent on fossil fuels, oil, whatever it may be, because there is technology out there that's being held from us. There is things that have been proposed to limit new wind energy. How do we find ways to gain access to these things that are available to us but are being held from us through dollars, through the oil companies, whoever it may be, the lobbying, the buying of political figures in our state? How do we bypass that? How do we limit that so that we are gained access, so they cannot be bought?
Thank you very much. I think those questions that you raise are indeed the most pertinent questions, and these will be the questions that we'll be raising before the government authorities as well. These are the questions that we think will make that should be raised before these government authorities. Thank you.
Thank you, Rusty, for sharing that. At this time, we'd like to call Rusty's wife, Jody Archambault Gillette.
Thank you, and the special rapporteur, I really want to extend my appreciation for you making the request, and I want to thank the University of Colorado Law School as well for helping the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and a lot of other tribes navigate the international process in a way that's productive and fruitful at the end of the day. My name is Jody Archambault Gillette, and I'm a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And I just wanted to talk about a few things that, as a citizen of my nation, of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and as a citizen of North Dakota, because I think there are some pretty crucial aspects that get brushed over in the course of dialogue that happens between Indian tribes and powers or states that they reside in. I think that you coming from the United Nations Human Rights Council is probably the most appropriate place to bring our challenges, because they're so deeply rooted in the way that the entire Western Hemisphere was settled, dating back to the doctrine of discovery, and understanding that we have few centuries, or more than a few centuries, at least 500 years of time to go back and look at some of the roots of how Indigenous peoples are viewed by Western societies. One of the things that we know to be true is that from the very beginning, the crowns in England were governed by what they call papal bulls, and they really listened to what certain sectors of religion believed about different parts of the world and different populations. And for a fact, I know that those kinds of beliefs that people of color are not quite human still exist in all of the different legal underpinnings that shape our country's decision making right now, and how they react to different kinds of voices and points of contention. The best example before you is the Dakota Access Pipeline, and when we talk about treaty lands, there is a common response by lawmakers, the Congressman King Kramer, the governor, you'll hear that that's not reservation land. It is treaty land that was reserved to our tribe in 1851, and it continues to be unceded lands that we fight for and we fight to protect. And the fact that the United States can so conveniently forget contracts that are within the, that are spelled out and ratified by Congress, and then also called out in the United States Constitution, gives us a lot of pause when we hear other kinds of promises that are made with respect to things like safety and mitigation and anything else that might come along in different takings across time. Lots of promises are made every time we're dispossessed of something, and our voice is rarely taken seriously, and it, like I said, it goes back to the early beginnings of us not being quite human. So the dehumanization of American Indians continues today. The discrediting of things that we say by both the corporation, by the United States, by our elected officials, by Wells Fargo, in a letter today to the city of Seattle, all call out the lies, that the supposed lies that we're saying. And these are not lies that we tell. We are only speaking our truth, and we are only telling our views about how we want our resources to be treated in our own territory. In this day and age, we have to ask ourselves why this continues to be a problem, and I think we have to go back to the beginning of whether or not Native Americans, American Indians, whether or not the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, or any peoples across the United States and in the Western Hemisphere fear are actually human beings. And when we ask the question of the destiny that we want for our children and our future, it becomes apparently, to me, it becomes very clear that there's nothing that we are asking for that isn't beyond the reaches of what anybody else would want. We are not asking for anything but to be respected as human beings. We are not asking for anything more than to be respected in our life ways, in our culture, in our language, and we want to be listened to. So there's a basic principle that I learned when working with families that are in crisis that I think would benefit any powerful country. And the first principle is asking what people think. So that's consultation. That's what the United States calls consultation. The next part is listening. It's very simple. You ask somebody something, you listen to what they say, and then you don't give up. So you don't give up on trying to help them reach their needs and help them get to where they want to go for their people. And every time you disregard somebody when you ask them a question, it's another strike against our humanity, and the time has got to stop. And only through the force, the moral force of bodies like the United Nations and the embarrassment that has to be brought upon the United States and the processes that exist within the Army Corps of Engineers and all of the federal governments, because I did work in the federal government, and I know how they get around these rules. How they get around consultation is they check a box and they can say that they consulted, and they say we have other stakeholders and we're weighing everybody's interests, and it doesn't matter whether or not the United States acknowledges that they did dispossess Native Americans based on an underpinning that we're not human. They just say it's because we have other interests that we have to balance. And usually when we're up against money, when we're up against organized labor, when we're up against powerful lobbies, we lose. We lose every single time, and it's time to stop. And so those are just some contradictions within the United States that we have to resolve. And I just have to say, and this is just a general observation, until we figure out how to get money out of politics, we'll still have the same levels of corruption that we see in the Trump administration and in former administrations. During other administrations, there is a level of money influence that influences decisions that is unbelievably out of control right now. And so that has to be something that people look over, that people before money is going to have to be an issue to examine for the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jody. Those are very important suggestions that you have made, and also going back to the roots of the problem. I think indeed it's the dominant mindset that discriminates against indigenous peoples that is really the root cause of many of the problems that I have seen so far here in the visit that I've made so far. I was also going to ask, what are your views, maybe if you can share some of your views in terms of how trust responsibility can be applied in the consultation processes?
So as far as the trust responsibility goes, there is a legal obligation of the United States to understand the weight of what that responsibility means, and it is a very discretionary use of a construct. So there is an obligation there, but the United States has found so many different ways to argue with itself and not uphold its trust responsibility throughout the time, throughout the years, that in this past administration, the Solicitor's Office and other, the Solicitor's Office in the Department of Interior, she did an opinion, an M opinion related to the Dakota Access Pipeline. And it's probably one of the better examples of how an agency can examine its treaty and trust responsibilities in light of a current day situation and challenge. It's I would say it's a best practice that could be utilized. The unfortunate part about that is that the next administration put that whole memorandum on hold. And so that's at the heart of the legal dispute right now and why the course was changed by the Trump administration to dismiss the treaty and trust responsibilities of the United States government is something that feels like it is not quite on solid ground. And I think there's got to be more work to educate the members of Congress on how to uphold that. I think there are not enough members of the legislative body who have a real, I don't want to say that there's people who have a real understanding, but then again, it's tied back to money. And so, people, the Republicans and the Democrats really do see Indian tribes having more strength and power because of the campaign contributions. Some of them have always understood the trust responsibility and look to correct and to advocate on behalf of tribes. But, now in this current day and age, I question the ability for them to strengthen that legislatively. And so I think that the other part is the trust responsibility does have to evolve. And there has to be more understanding of nation-to-nation type of negotiation so that the tribe itself can set those parameters and it's not a one-size-fits-all because there are different, tribes are different and they are unique from each other and you can't assume that what one tribe wants is what all tribes want. And it really should be something that is undertaken as a longer-term project because we don't want to change the special obligation and political and legal responsibilities of the federal government to something that is assimilative, that where we become assimilated, but we also know that it needs to evolve and it needs to transform into something that is more functional to fit the needs of the tribe.
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed, the nation-to-nation relationships have to really be clearly defined what exactly that means, and it should be tailor-fitted to the specificities of the various tribes. And of course, the trust responsibility, again, has to be defined in much more concrete terms as far as how it affects the tribes whenever projects are decided at the national level or pushed by the corporations for the government to undertake. Maybe this can be the last one because we need to go to meet with the Historic Preservation Authority as well as the governor.
Good afternoon, ladies. Take my hat off to you. My name is Jeff Baker. I am Anishinaabe from the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe. Anishinaabe refers to the original man of this piece of earth. Basically, many tribes are the people of the earth, sprang from the earth, etc. I wasn't planning on being here, otherwise I would have worn my Sunday go-to meeting suit, and stuff like that. But I come to you as a human being, nothing more, nothing less. I think people fail to understand that we've had 500 years of political, social, economic, and physical genocide perpetrated against us. We have 250 years of a federalized system that has abused us. We are the first people of this continent, this Turtle Island, yet we were the last ones to be gifted citizenship by a magical wand in Washington, D.C. The white man has always written his laws down. We say because it helps him keep track of the lies he told previously. And to me, a man, like many tribal nations, only needs his word if you have true honor. That's how we pray from our heart to the Creator, Gichimatu, Takashla, God, Allah, no matter how you know that being. So for us, we don't need to write down truth and honor and humanity. It's existed in us before any other color got here. So to me, I weigh this question. If the non-Indian in Washington, D.C. lays claim to democracy and his legal power and his legally binding documentation, yet he does not believe he has to live by those same laws and those same documentations, how are we to accept that? If there's no honor in your written word, no honor in your spoken word, then you are not an honorable human being. Now, I studied law, constitutional law, when I was an undergrad, and I know there's always an Achilles heel. That's the greatest thing I thought about because I had contemplated law school. There's always a chink in his armor, and I've noticed that. But in our case, it says in their documentation that the treaties of the United States with the indigenous peoples of this nation are to be accepted as the supreme law of this land, no different from their constitution that they hold so dear to their heart, and which they place their hand on their Bible. So they're bound by it until they leave this earth. Now, how are we to interpret laws if they only affect and only benefit one color of a man, while the other colors are left to be victimized by it? We are not participants in democracy. We are victims of it. So to me, how can we approach a man that has never lived by that honorable code he brags throughout the world, yet in our case as indigenous people, he ignores it? To us, until the United States Constitution means nothing, then we are not bound by it. To me, the United States government is legally documented and bound by his agreement. If he doesn't want to live by it, then he should abdicate his rule. To me, I say, I've been in back and forth to Washington, D.C. for 30 years on behalf of my people, and it's the same thing. There's 250 years of hot air that we could spin these wind turbines up north for 250 years. But to me, without the same footing that every other non-Indian, Christian, democratic, patriotic person has in this world, we will have nothing. That's their measurement. Our measurement is you're bound by it because you wrote it. So, in my opinion, as a human being, they won't consult with us on a meaningful position because they are bound by it, but they want to ignore it. So, when you get to Washington, as well as this state, I was there the other day, and if you walk into the state house as a person of color, they stare at you like you're out of place. What are you doing here? 99.9% non-Indian. So we can't accomplish anything here. Our current representatives hate us because we're fighting for justice and we're fighting for basic human rights, which is clean water. It's not about the oil. The oil is going to flow. It's going to contaminate a lot of stuff. Now you go to Washington, you have a gentleman in charge that hates us even worse than our local representatives. So in that case, President Trump blames us for his economic woes in his casinos. So he's going to stomp on us natives hard. He's going to use legal and economic genocide against us for the next 4 years if he makes it that far. And, you know, we're all in the same canoe for 4 years that we know. So I ask you to ask them simply, if you love this Constitution and you love this Bible you place your hand upon and you truly believe it, then we must have the same footing as every other citizen. Like I said before, the first people, the last citizens of this great democratic society we know as the United States of America. So with that, I thank you. I wish you luck. And we pray for everybody. And we ask that you accept our blessings and hope you have a safe trip home. And with that, Bamatasiwin, which means in our language, walk the red road as a human being. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Very wise words from a young man. And I think that your words in relation to raising this issue in before the government authorities is really it's the right on target. This is exactly the key message that I would like to ask. How is it that you have a constitution which is supposed to promote equality and non-discrimination, and yet in many of the visits that I did, I have heard stories of how the natives of the original people of the United States have been treated in the worst and discriminatory ways, as well as in the worst unequal ways. And I think that's really the core issue that needs to be faced by this government of the United States of America. Thank you very much.
Those were the closing remarks of Victoria Tauli Corpez at a UN listening session, March 1st, 2017 at United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. Ms. Tauli Corpez is the special reporter on the rights of indigenous peoples in the UN's Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner. Her visit to North Dakota included stops at Standing Rock and the MHA Nation. Her purpose was to learn directly from Native people how they are affected by energy development. Speakers at the UTT session included Crow Creek Tribal Chairman Brandon Sazu Sr., UTT student Corey Harryshirt, who provided the prayer, Standing Rock Elder Mary Louise Defender Wilson, Rusty Gillette and Jody Gillette of Bismarck, and also Jeff Baker. A full report on the findings from the North Dakota visit is to be released to the public by the United Nations. This program was produced by United Tribes Technical College, Office of Public Information. Dennis Newman, Director. Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, Producer. This series is designed not only to strengthen our communities, but to give insight and understanding of a tribal culture and a Native people. For more information, visit our website, uttc.edu.